information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
Politics and media tricks. Unless we live in some impossibly remote location, divorced from television, internet, press, and radio sources, we all encounter the media to some degree. Politics feed on it, gaining publicity and also criticism, while alternative views are often disparaged. Both paranormal topics and conspiracy theories become the hallmark of the nut, wheeled on for a little light relief, but no serious analysis. Our worldviews are created by these media tricks, making it harder to alert the population to the impact of new information. Can these tricks be revealed for what they are, through careful scrutiny and personal experience? So joining me now on the line from Hove in the southeast of England is an old friend of ours on the information, Nigel Furness. Hi, Nigel.
Hi, Peter.
So I'm just mulling over a few thoughts there on politics and how they impact with what we're told by the media and what we're not told, and that obviously crosses over with conspiracy and paranormal topics, which are often trivialised in the media. Do you feel that could be a problem?
I feel it's a very large problem. Funnily enough, I was only discussing this very thing last night while having a pint, and I was saying that, you know, frankly, now the news, doesn't matter which of the terrestrial channels you watch, the news to me is completely dumbed down, and if it's, you know, if it's not dumbed down, you just get constant repetition of the same old song. I mean, I'm sick and tired of hearing about the Murdoch scandal on News International. It goes on and on and on. And I, you know, while discussing, you know, with a few people outside the pub having a fag, we came to the conclusion that what they're trying to do is basically just bore people rigid and put them off listening to the news. They might then put in a little snatch of something important or nothing at all. Because more and more people that I was talking to were saying, well, actually, I find it exactly the same. It's just such a lot of you-know-what, you know, that I just turn it off. I switch channels. And a guy I was talking to agreed with me that the best news you'll find is on the BBC. It's Channel 80 for anybody with a dingy box.
Yeah.
And you'll find that, you know, most of the time you'll get better news on that, but always after, say, about 11 or something like that, or even more into the early hours, you'll get the real news stories there. And amazingly, you never hear of them again. They're just lost in space, cyberspace, or whatever, because they don't, you know, you think, oh, that'll be on tomorrow's news, tomorrow being later today. And it isn't. And, of course, another thing, which I find excellent, but, I mean, they're only on certain times. Not everybody can get them. I can get them, and that's Al Jazeera.
Oh, yeah.
And Al Jazeera, you know, one would think at first, oh, dear, you know, that'll be a lot of sort of Arab or Al-Qaeda propaganda. There's no propaganda whatsoever.
So this is an English language service.
And perfect English. Better English, I might add, than a lot of our actual, our own newscasters, you know, Arab ladies and Arab men, you know, putting across the world stories. And what I love about Al Jazeera, there's absolutely no spin.
Hmm.
No, I feel there's a very deliberate thing going on here.
Hmm.
And I'll tell you something, too, dating right back to the 1970s.
Oh,
my family, as you know, come from... just one second.
Yeah.
Don't
mention any actual addresses on here,
Nigel.
No, that's fine.
I wouldn't do anything like that. But no, my family come from Northern Ireland. I used to be, you know, going to and fro a lot of the time. I have all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the 70s, you know, at the height of the Troubles, you would never hear things that were happening over there on the English BBC News. Now, the BBC News, I was always given to understand, was for the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
To this day, my family will ring me up, or I'll ring them up, and they'll say, you know, I bet you didn't hear about this on your news. No. And likewise, I'll ring them up and say, I bet you never heard about this. So, I mean, that's been going on for over 40 years.
Mm. So it's only by comparing the two that you see the difference there.
Yes, you'd be blissfully unaware. And you see, coming from an Irish family, I have family, you know, dotted all over the British Isles, America, etc., Canada, a lot of them. And, you know, again, you know, when you talk, families do talk, communicate by phone. And then, you know, you hear things there again that you've not never heard anything of down here. Things are happening, for example, up in places like Oldham, Bradford, Manchester, Liverpool, that never get onto the news here, you know.
Yeah, of course, when we've had the London riots, we suddenly had a lot of news coverage, and I did sit up watching the News 24, and that was, you know, you get a broad coverage then, but most of the time you might not in the same way.
Exactly right. I've noticed that too. You then get, you know, the sort of the news the next day when you've been up half the night, because if there is anything important like that, you know, I'll stay up as long as my eyes stay open. And you know, the next day comes. And, you know, I mean, this came about some years ago again, you know, the grumpy old men's call, and now you can't smoke inside pubs. Actually, that's had an upside in that it's got total strangers talking. You know, my circle of contacts has increased enormously as a result of it. You know, people feel much freer. They feel like refugees, and they've all got something in common. And, you know, you hear that from people saying, you know, that at first people would say, well, where the hell are you getting your information from, Nigel, you know? You've imagined that. I said, no, just stay up and watch the late news, or, you know, tape it. Tape the late news for a few hours and whiz through it, and you'll see what I mean. Because the things you hear on there too, you don't even necessarily see in the papers the next day or later that day. There's a definite policy about this. This is no accident.
No. Do you think the media's gone downhill since the 70s and early 80s, maybe? Things changed a lot in that period.
I mean, you've only to look at the local paper, the Argus. I mean, that really did used to be a thoroughly good local paper. And it was a very investigative paper, a lot of stories that came from the Argus. The handiwork of Argus reporters became national news. And a lot of those reporters, of course, then, you know, were obviously coaxed away to national papers. But, I mean, the trouble with the Argus is a few years ago, 7 years ago, they had a revamp under that Michael Beard, who's now the editor, and they said at the time that they were appealing to the 30 to 35 age trendies. And the fact is, 30 to 35 year old trendies that have invaded this town, no disrespect to them, but they're not really likely to be interested in local news.
No,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, in that decade, of course, the internet took off a lot, and the various mobile devices with Android and the iPhones and stuff took off a lot. And I think you've got now the sort of things that are almost like electronic newspapers you can hold in your hand. And I don't know if the Argus really caught up with that. It kind of, and the Argus is a Brighton newspaper, to explain to anyone listening to this anywhere in the world.
Yes,
but it's typical of many. I think in America, the local newspapers are thought of as proper newspapers, and they are a local newspaper. But in this country, the local newspaper is kind of adverts for cars and double glazing and some rather trashy stories stuck on the end of it. And
that's right.
It used to be a lot better, you know.
Oh, gotcha. I mean, the local paper, you know, if you were to ring you know, the Argus before, which over the many years I did, and alerted them to stories. I won't mention names or go into them here, but, you know, they'd be straight on the case, and they'd be on the phone around to see you, you know, in a flash, or meet you at whatever site that was, you know, you were talking about. Now, you know, you try and alert them of things, they never, ever get back to me.
No, they've got no actual editorial offices in the town itself.
It's Southampton, I believe.
And our local television here is based in Southampton too, so we've got a real spot here. All we've got is the radio, the local radio, which is quite good, but even that's only in the morning.
Well, the local radio is another thing. I mean, what now is BBC Sussex? You know, its predecessor, Southern Counties Radio, was worse than BBC Sussex, at least a bit more local now. But, I mean, you get on, you know, if you put on the radio, I put it on, of course, for the in the background for the local news, but, you know, they'll take a story and the entire ruddy day it will go from one presenter to the other knocking about this subject. It's what I've been saying before about just boring you absolutely rigid. It's almost like a form of brainwash, if you know what I mean. It's enough to make you say, I just don't want to know what's going on in the world, and I have a theory about that too. It's a very controversial one. The way the pubs are coming under fire, under attack now. I mean, today's Argus, and I won't call it the Brighton Argus, because it's more Eastbourne, one end Hastings at the other, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
I mean, not long ago, we had the City Edition.
Well, that died a death. Yeah, they wanted to do two editions, thinking all the trendies would buy it, and
that's
of course, they weren't interested.
And that, frankly, has been responsible for the near death of the paper, as far as I'm concerned. I believe the paper is actually dead, but it hasn't quite got round to reporting it yet.
Yeah.
But I was saying about the radio. Going back 40, 30 years ago, you know, Radio Brighton was absolutely brilliant. And at the time that they decided to merge it into Radio Sussex, I can well remember Steve Bassam, now Lord Bassam of Brighton, who was the leader of the council, refusing, and so did the Tory opposition. And all the political parties said, we're not going up to Guildford, because that's where they had the thing. Sorry, not when it became Radio Sussex, when it became Radio Southern County.
Okay, yeah.
And they said, well, they all point-blank refused to have anything to do with the radio stations. They said, we're not going up to Guildford for an interview about something happening in Sussex, and more to the point, and what used to be the Radio Brighton area.
Mm.
We're getting regress here with the media, Peter. It isn't progress.
So what's strange is that you've got a growth in like the internet and the social media and the mobile devices. We don't really even call them phones now, because they're all kind of every sort of gadget in a piece
Blackberry
of hardware.
Or whatever.
Yeah, but on the other hand, a lot of the media, they call it old media in a rather disparaging way, but that's sort of attracted a lot. But in a way, they've got like lots of TV channels, but the old joke is 1,000 channels with nothing on to watch, you know.
Absolutely right.
It would be easier now to give good coverage to a lot of these local politics and stuff, and they make it far worse than when they used to have hot metal printing and stuff. And I know you told me an interesting story, because I've broadened it out a little bit from purely local stuff, but this is local too, that you went to, is it the Question Time TV programme some time ago?
Yes.
And you were in the audience.
Right.
You told me a very interesting anecdote about how that uses a bit of misrepresentation.
Well, it does, because what they do, they're very sneaky. They claim that programme is live. The programme actually isn't live. It's going out. It's only very short time ahead, 3 minutes, I would say, maximum. They do this so that they can screen out anything controversial. This is why it always seems to go so flawed.
Well, just explain to anyone who doesn't know, it's a TV show that goes out every week, and it's got national politicians, and they're interviewed in a local town with a live audience supposedly watching it.
Yes, and the audience can put in questions beforehand, and also they can say, anybody like to raise their hand. They can be very good at not noticing whose hand is raised, but then that's not exclusive to that particular programme. But what did get me was they had this sort of what David Dimbleby, who was superb in getting everybody, you know, feeling comfortable. He came around and individually introduced to every single person there,
mm-hmm.
and was very jolly, you know, a charming fella. And then they had what they called a warm-up, or he said a roustabout, and they got bits and bobs. Now, what I noticed was, I set the my video recorder for the program. What I noticed was, when I watched that later that evening, bits from the roustabout were actually in the supposedly live program.
Right.
And bits from the live programme, including something that I was commenting on, something the Labour Party conference, and about the pro-hunt people lobby, you know, dumping dead horses in Queen's Road.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was cut out. And yet a cousin of mine in Northern Ireland said, but I heard your voice. And I thought, you know, am I imagining things, she said. I clearly heard your voice. I heard you shout. It was a dead horse. In fact, it was two dead horses. So whatever they did to cut that out, they managed to cut my face and everything out of it, but you heard me actually shouting back at them.
Mm. So what they have is another VTR machine with a bit of pre-recorded stuff they took in the warm-up.
Is that what they do? I don't know, because I'm not really tech savvy.
Well, if you imagine, yeah, they're doing it live, but they must have a bit of that recording put on a video player, and it's run for a mixer, so when it gets a bit too controversial, they hit a button and go, we'll play a bit of the roustabout at the start, where they're all just clapping.
And what they do? Well, they're very clever at how they do it, I have to say, because it is only, say, a maximum of 3 minutes, maybe even as little as 2 minutes ahead, you know, because, I mean, the lady I was with, we checked our watches, and she said, well, just a minute, this is fast. So, you know, and a number of other people made the same point. This isn't actually, for argument's sake, it's meant to be 8 o'clock, and in actual fact, it wasn't.
Well, that's interesting, yes, you can spot the difference like that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's plain as the nose in your face, because you think, oh, we've got a couple of minutes, it's still the roustabout, and then all of a sudden, with indecent taste, that music, the lights go down, they come up on the stage, and bang, 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 you know, you're straight into the thing.
Yeah. Well, it does show how, I mean, when the people talk about things like the moon landings, oh, it can never be faked and stuff like that, and it was all live on TV.
Oh, I think they can.
when you see something like this, you kind of go, well, they could drop in little bits if they wanted to from another source.
Well, that was one of the things. I mean, I never used to believe in these theories, as you know, about the moon landings being fake, and I still think it's six of one, half dozen the other. Mm. But it was actually that question time there. I'm glad you raised the point that made me think, well, yes, if they can do that with this program, what else can they muck about with? You know, it's a shame because you do like to think, well, I like to think that if I'm watching the television or listening to the radio, particularly the BBC, the British Broadcasting Companies, I'm being told the truth.
Mm.
And it's disappointing more than anything else.
Mm. Well, I spotted something on TV recently. I think it was on Channel 4, so we can't just blame the BBC, but it was when they were covering on the Channel 4 news. It was when the stuff was happening in Libya. I think Gaddafi had been ousted or they'd taken over or something like that in Tripoli. And they said on the news, this was at 7 o'clock in the evening, so it's like the kind of main dinner time news, evening news. Oh, this is live from Manchester. People are cheering in the streets. You know, Libyans living in Manchester are cheering in the streets. And it said live. And it showed Manchester, but it was absolutely night. And they were dancing around. But it said it's at night. I could see it's dark. Now I look out the window and it's 7 o'clock. Broad daylight.
Yes, plenty of sunshine still.
So this is early September, you know. Yep. Suddenly I think, well, I know there's a slight difference in the latitude between Manchester and Brighton. But, I mean, we're not talking about more than, you know, like sort of 300 miles. It's not going to be daylight in one and night in another, you know. Yeah. And this was done again. And I think what happened was they were cheering the evening before, at night, earlier, you know, at midnight, 20 hours before, and that had been recorded and used. It was quite blatant, and I was amazed. They cut to a live reporter, but I think she was inside a room, so it was lit with artificial light, so you could have said it's live, and you couldn't match it with the other footage outside. So the whole thing was like, okay, yeah, but that's very, very naughty what they did there, you know.
It's extremely devious, and frankly, it's deeply worrying because it's the sort of thing I would expect of a tyranny. It's not what I would expect of a supposedly democratic country, which I have a great belief in. It's very disappointing.
Mm.
And another thing, Peter, yeah, I can mention on this. You know, it must be 4 or 5 years ago now, they had this. They brought in this business of releasing government files and, you know, things that have been kept secret and everything from 30 years or 40 years previously or whatever it was.
Yeah, 30-year rule, I think, yeah.
50-year, whatever.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine, who remained nameless, was always a little bit of a sceptic because of my trade union political past back in the 70s. And, you know, I'm sure he always thought, he's only known me about 20 years, oh, yes, you do go on night. And I remember him saying, well, the truth will out, said he. He said, because next week it'll be the release of the files of everything that happened in 1973.
Hmm.
And in 1973, that was when I was heavily involved in the CPSA, which stood for, long defunct now, the Civil and Public Services Association, which I very nearly became president at the age of 22.
Hmm.
And I was representing the Customs and Excise.
So is that like a union, basically?
Yes, it was, yes, a trade union representing civil servants in various departments. And we went on strike. It was illegal for the customs officers to go on strike, as it still is for soldiers or police. And I led them out on strike. There's only 11 of us in the union in Shoreham Port.
Okay.
Now, that's the port now on its knees.
Famous for its live animal exports about 15 years after.
Well, yes, well before that.
Yeah.
Well, the decline of the port, I'm very sorry to say this, but I have to admit our militant trade union activity did not really do the port of Shoreham any good at all. That I freely admit. But, I mean, you know, we didn't provoke the action in the first place. The animal exports things, I think that was the final nail in the coffin.
Yeah, sure. Anyway, we'll...
But anyway, to get to the point, we led the customs men out on strike, and I rang up the union at the HQ, and they came down from Balham, and they said, right, well, if this matter can't be resolved, they said that, and read out a list beginning in alphabetical order with Belfast and Heathrow and Gatwick, all ports and airports, the customs people will walk out, not only walk out, but will picket the whole lot of them, which they did.
Yeah.
Ted Heath, the situation was so serious, Ted Heath came down. I arranged to meet Ted Heath. I had no intention of meeting him, but I arranged to meet him. He came down to the Custom House in Southwark. We had, by the way, on that very first day of this accident, we walked across the harbour and saw the Transport General Workers Union people, who immediately backed us because the coal, I said, the coal is black, the old trade union term black, you're handling goods, you know, that your trade fellow trade unionists have not authorised, yeah. Is the word I'm looking for. They went on strike and they switched off the power station, and of course the bosses in the Custom House said, well, you can do what you want, there's such a thing as the national grid. I said, you don't mind if we put that theory to the test. Immediately they pulled up the big old leaves in the power station, the lights, we could see the view right along the Bay of Sussex, the lights all started flickering and going out. Ted Heath came down, we got the miners involved, and this is how the miners became involved that year, because first and foremost they took action, would you believe, to support customs and excise people. And that then escalated into one of the several miners' strikes in the 70s. Ted Heath was blockaded inside the Custom House and couldn't get out for it. I can't remember now if it was either an hour and a half or 2.5 hours. Not one bit of that appeared in any papers, in the local paper, on the news, on the radio, anything. That was completely blanked out. And when they released, the interesting thing is, when they released all, you know, the big goings-on in 1973, even my friend, who remains nameless, said, well, I begin to see what you mean, he said, because there's not a word, there's not a thing about you in it. And I said, right, well, I'll show you my files. I'll show you all the press cuttings. And that made him, and he's a real right-wing Tory type, that made him begin to question things. So you see.
Yeah, it may have been a D-notice used there.
Well, what? Because
notice,
there was a D-notice authorised by John Major in 1997. Against all the papers. And you know, would you believe the much maligned Radio Sussex defied the D-notice and had the story on all day? And that was when John Major took me to the High Court because I'd formed a breakaway. I'd become, this is very odd, isn't it, from being a radical trade unionist. I had graduated into becoming a conservative and then fed up with the conservatives of John Major. Along with other colleagues, we set up the official Hove Conservative Party, which completely legal, because I found out that the Conservatives had no copyright on the word conservative.
No.
And they still don't. I do. And if you care to, for anybody that doesn't believe me, if you look at all, get hold of all the conservative propaganda that you can, leaflets, etc., and you will never see the Conservative Party. And another thing you'll never see is the official Conservative Party. And I've got all the different leaflets they had to put out when we challenged them at the polls, and this is what turned Hove Labour in 1995. We were formed in 1991. And in 1997, of course, Ivor Caplin became the first ever Labour MP for Hove.
Mm.
Prior to that general election was when I was challenged the very night before a High Court hearing. Now, try that for size.
Mm.
I was slapped on the chest with a big fat brown envelope. There was a ring on my doorbell, and it was a person who remained nameless, but who at that time was a Conservative councillor in Hove. This is for you, said he, and you're something rather nasty, which I won't repeat over the air, but anyway, I went to the High Court the following morning. I was accused, I was jointly accused, by the way, with the Labour Council of Brighton and Hove, Brighton and Hove Council. It wasn't City Council in those days.
No.
Jointly accused, myself and Claire Lloyd-Jones, who was the returning officer for Brighton, of conspiracy to defraud the electorate. I spoke for, I don't think it was quite 5 minutes. Now, the council had a barrister who, frankly, was useless. The Tories had a barrister who was even more useless, and I just said, my lord, may I? You may indeed. I said, I'd just like to clarify a few points. It took less than 5 minutes. Enough, cried the judge. Mr. Furness, you've convinced me. You're free to leave this court. When I got out of the court, I thought, well, there must be something big going on here, because bear in mind, John Major's name was not on that petition. It was a guy called Robert Guy, who was
the right guy for Hove.
The right guy for Hove, exactly, and the, quotes, official guy for Hove, highly amusing. Who is this guy, said we, but that's diverting. On the steps, anyway, there was a huge battery, all these lights came on, huge battery of cameras flashing. I thought, what on earth is going on here? here today. Never thinking for one moment it was me. And it was only through CNN News of America it took me nearly 3 hours to get away from the steps. I gave that many interviews. And I'm not talking just British media, I'm talking about all over the world. And it was the CII guy who said, Mr. Furness, do you realise, said he, holding his hands apart, about a foot apart, that the Prime Minister, Mr. Major, has a file about this thick on his desk concerning you? And I said, well, I am disappointed. And I held my hands apart about 3 feet. I said, I would have expected to have been at least this size. Oh, brilliant, said he. May we broadcast? I said, yes, you. I said, you better. And yet, nothing appeared except when I got back to our campaigning HQ in Hove. Come in quick, said my agent. And there, just as I came in the door, BBC Sussex, which shows how good it used to be,
yeah.
Radio Sussex, you join us now as the big news story of the day. Nigel Furness has won his High Court battle with John Major.
Wow.
That was the first I'd heard, and for a start, who the hell was Nigel Furness? Who had ever heard of me? And they had a guy, a political analyst from Sussex University, that was speaking. They said, well, Professor, whoever it was, can you please tell us what's going on? And he said, well, frankly, because he said, we appear to have two perfectly bona fide conservative candidates. And something else that was never mentioned, I never found this mentioned anywhere else, but I sat up, I didn't sit up late, I was up late in the town hall, and they had, you know, a battery of televisions, I think, one for each of the four terrestrial channels.
Oh, yeah.
And you know how you wander around, and you go, and everybody say, oh, Nigel, quick, look at this, there's two conservative candidates here, there's three there, there's even four somewhere, Blackburn, I think. So all over the country, that had freed people to do exactly the same thing. So New Labour really did not win that election. The Tories lost it, and it was because of our tactics, as well as tactical voting. But you see, isn't it amazing? But for anybody who was there at the time, and thank goodness I have lots of people who were there who can verify this, you know.
So a friend of yours mentioned that
he'd have... I say, unfortunately, Peter, you can't blame people. I don't blame people. You know, when we say about, oh, well, the moon landings or this or that, people say, oh, God, you're all a load of nutters, or how much you had to drink. I might have been very much the same. Let me just add this. Mm-hmm. If it hadn't been for seeing things with my own eyes and hearing them with my own ears, and that made me think, and I just wish other people would.
So it's the personal experience is the thing that really...
Yes.
Hammers at home, isn't it, when you have some
way, Peter.
Your actual worldview is shaken by the fact that you see what your experience is different from how it's reported in the media.
Shaken to the foundations.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, certainly the Argus, the local paper, has often been something that pushes agendas and pushes the mainstream view, as a lot of the media are. And we've just had, of course, the anniversary of 9/11, and again, any attempt to get other views in the media failed there completely. I'm not blaming the Argus.
Well, exactly.
But generally speaking, you know, it's trivialised. I know the Green Party, which is in power in Brighton, when we're talking, I mean, that passed at its conference some years ago a motion that it would support the official story of 9/11. It wouldn't even be bothered to look into...
Did it really?
Yeah, so it's...
That's actually quite shocking.
It is shocking. It's really shocking that the members would be bothered to even want to put a motion that would bring that point up and go out the way.
Quite shocking, Peter.
Yeah, it is. It is, and... another thing we're having to contend with, of course, in this area is possible boundary changes that might alter these towns. We've got two towns that were made into a city, but they've kept their identity to some degree. We were always told they would, and now they're going to be mixed up so that they're almost manipulating the areas where you vote to get a version of events that they want to be true, you know, and you get this non-defined, non-local kind of area that you're meant to be part of, where you may be part of half a town and half another town and not one town, and it's all very confusing, and I think it leads to a feeling of detachment in voters and the public in general.
I think it's deliberate. I think it's an attempt to break up communities. I think it's an attempt at gerrymandering, and furthermore, at the root of all this, what one must never forget, is the European Union's fanatical push to abolish nationhood, as it were. Don't forget this interreg business between Normandy and the southeast of England was described, and I believe still is described, as the interreg or the
transmunch,
however you pronounce it. I don't pretend to speak French. Region. Now, this is something which I find absolutely deplorable, and it was never on the agenda of the principles of the original common market, six member states. This is something the Eurocrats are very big on pushing. One thing I would love to know is why our British politicians, local and national alike, and European, are so in love with the idea of giving up their own power. I mean, I've never heard of turkeys voting for Christmas. I don't understand it. Germany and France, you know, they stand up to the European Union. It was their invention. It's puzzling. It's baffling. I could never quite understand it. And the whole thing is going to come crumbling down. I said this on the radio. Sussex used to ring me up regularly and ask, would I like to, just on the air, you know, sometimes go into the studio. They had a matter they were going to throw up to debate, and it was rather like a local question type thing. Of course, I mean, I always obliged, and in those days, Radio Sussex would let you have your head. You could say, nowadays, oh dear, no, we don't want him, far too controversial. Yeah. Again, everything is so dumbed down. We don't need a nanny state. Here we are preaching and getting militarily involved in the Libyan issue and preaching to Libyan people and other Arab nations about, you know, the particulars of democracy. I think it's a bit rich.
Nigel, that's great. Thanks very much.
Okay, lovely.
The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.